If you lost one game with Maccabi, he said, there was a countrywide investigation. The hiring became official just a little more than 24 hours before the draft. On the same day, James opted out of his contract with the Heat. The Cavs and the rest of the league certainly noticed, but it did not greatly change their focus. Blatt and Lou weren't part of the evaluation process for the draft picks, which Griffin was conducting. The Cavs had favored Wiggins from the start, specifically because he'd shown a commitment to playing defense in his season at Kansas, and Parker, who was a massively talented offensive player, had not during his year at Duke. Then there was Parker's workout with the team, which was a buzzkill. The Cavs were astounded at what they perceived was a lack of intensity and energy during the visit from Parker, to the point they suspected he'd tanked the workout in an effort to get the Cavs not to draft him. The Milwaukee Bucks, who had the number 2 pick, were closer to Parker's hometown of Chicago. Nonetheless, here was another top player who looked like he didn't want to be in Cleveland. Not exactly a jolt of confidence for a team hoping to rebuild itself quickly. On draft night, the pick was easy for the Cavs. They took Wiggins, number 1. What Blatt and Lou were doing that week, however, was talking to Irving. After taking over as interim GM the previous winter, Griffin made creating a bond with Irving a priority. Irving's first 3 years in the league had been traumatic, as he'd gone through several coaches and several systems and had to watch the Cavs mishandle draft picks and slow play other improvements around him. Irving's father, Dredderick, was a huge influence in his life. Dred, as his friends called him, grew up in a housing project in the Bronx as part of a large single-parent family. He quickly became a basketball star in high school and later at Boston University. There he met Elizabeth, who was the daughter of a Lutheran minister, a trained classical pianist, and on the university's volleyball team. They later married. After college, Dred signed to play for a team in Melbourne, Australia, where Kyrie was born. When Irving was 4, Elizabeth passed away from an illness, a moment that shaped his life. Even as an adult, Irving has said filling out paperwork halts him when he has to leave his mother's information blank. The family ended up settling in New Jersey. On September 11, 2001, Dredderick was walking through the lobby of Tower 1 at the World Trade Center when the first plane hit the building. He'd worked there for years as a stockbroker for Cantor Fitzgerald, the firm that took a direct hit from the aircraft. He'd recently moved to a nearby building, but he wasn't sure his children knew and he couldn't reach them. He ended up walking to the Bronx that day to find a way to get home, his 10-year-old son wondering if he'd lost a second parent. Irving became a teenage star like his father before him. The two poured in hours working on technique, with his father schooling him on how to practice awkward shots that would trick defenders. On weekends, Dredderick would take his son back to the Mitchell Projects in the Bronx, letting Irving learn to play on the blacktops as he did. Irving loved practicing dribbling, working on moves for hours. He studied star Rod Strickland, a close friend of his father's, and his ability to use his dribble to score below the rim. He watched Allen Iverson highlights on YouTube. He loved Jason Williams, the slick point guard of the Sacramento Kings, who had the nickname White Chocolate. I'd watch the highlights on YouTube and I'd go out on my driveway and try it. And then I'd watch more YouTube videos and then I'd go back out and try it. It would be an all-night thing, Irving said. It was not being afraid to try that move your coach tells you not to do, like being on a fast break and doing double moves and your coach wants you to do a regular layup. I don't believe in that. I believe in having creativity in the game and bringing excitement to what everyone kind of is afraid to do. Irving attended a private school power, St. Patrick, where his highlights eventually became YouTube hits. One of his teammates, Michael Kidd Gilchrist, later became the number 2 overall pick in the draft. They were one of the best high school teams in the nation. Irving would become the number 1 recruit in the nation and ended up at Duke. Dred was by his son's side always. He was very present in Cleveland in Irving's first years there, and his displeasure over the direction of the franchise was not quiet. The Cavs got sufficiently concerned over Irving's willingness to sign an extension with the organization that they held internal conversations about trading him. Highlighting the disconnect, Brown was in favor of moving him despite his immense talent. The Cavs ultimately ruled it out, but there were fractures in the relationship. From the moment Griffin took the job, he worked on managing the Irving relationship. During the coaching search, they kept in regular contact. As soon as Blatt and Lou were hired, Griffin put them in touch with Irving. Griffin came from an offensive background in Phoenix, and he made it clear offense would be a part of the team's future, not as much as the defense-based team under Brown. As with much of the league, Kyrie and Dredd had a positive opinion of Lou, a former point guard now in position to be a major part of the organization. All of these were seen as positive signs from Irving's perspective. Even with their stated mission of improving the team quickly that summer, and despite having $20 million in cap space, the Cavs' first free agent move was to approach a player under contract. That was Irving, who was eligible to sign an extension that would kick in the following year. The Cavs had until October 31st to do such a deal, but they wanted to make Irving their number one priority. So on June 30th, Gilbert and minority owners Forbes and Jeff Cohen joined Griffin, Blatt, and Lou on a jet to New York City. There, at midnight on July 1st, they had dinner in a private dining room in the basement of a Manhattan restaurant with the Irvings and Kyrie's agent, Jeff Wexler. They formally presented a 5-year, $90 million extension offer. While the promises and conversations in the room were important, the groundwork laid by Griffin, Blatt, and Lou prior to the meeting had already convinced Irving things would be different. The prospect of James joining the team was not a major topic of conversation, but other free agents the Cavs were going to chase were discussed. Around 1:30 a.m., the party shook hands. The deal was done. As the Irving deal was being closed, other members of the Cavs' front office were calling free agents. They had several on their radar. They called Gordon Hayward, who'd had a promising start to his career in 4 years with the Utah Jazz. The Cavs envisioned Wiggins starting at shooting guard and Hayward, who was from nearby Indianapolis, at small forward, with the newly committed Irving running the point. The Cavs also called Chandler Parsons, another young small forward who surprisingly became a free agent when the Houston Rockets didn't pick up an option in his contract. The Cavs were also interested in veterans like Trevor Ariza and Channing Frye. At about 2 a.m., as Griffin headed back to his hotel, he called Paul and let him know the Cavs were interested in James too. Paul thanked him for the interest and told him they would be in touch. No promises, no hints. The Cavs moved on with their business. On July 2nd, the Cavs set up a visit with Hayward, who was a restricted free agent, for the next day. If the visit went well, there was an understanding that the Cavs might be ready to offer him a 4-year maximum level contract that started at $15 million for the next season, the bulk of the Cavs' available cap space. Gilbert's jet flew to Indianapolis and picked Hayward up. But on that day, July 3rd, something happened. Even as the Cavs prepared to show Hayward around their practice facility and have him meet with Blatt, Griffin's phone rang. It was Paul. He'd told Griffin he'd be meeting with teams regarding James's free agency over the next few days at his office in downtown Cleveland. James was not a lock to return to the Heat. He was indeed on the market. Was this the moment the Cavs had been dreaming of? They weren't sure. But they had to call Hayward's agent. There would be no contract offer right then. The Cavs had just slammed on the brakes. On everything. Chapter 3. Midnight in Miami. There was exhaustion. There was relief. There may have even been a little joy. It was certainly unlike most finals losing locker rooms in NBA history. This was June 2014, the fourth year in a row the Miami Heat had made it to the championship round, and it was the first time they'd been outclassed, losing in 5 games to the San Antonio Spurs. The reality and finality of it left the room devoid of the type of pain usually reserved for the end of a long journey. The duration and the circumstances had stripped it all away. The finals had been frustrating. After he scored a basket to make it a 2-point game with 4 minutes left in Game 1 in San Antonio, LeBron James's legs cramped so badly that he had to leave the game, and the Spurs instantly pulled away for the victory. The air conditioning had failed inside the AT&T Center, and temperatures on the court surpassed 90 degrees. Some suspected it was a ploy by the Spurs akin to those of the Boston Celtics coaching great Red Auerbach, who was accused of manipulating temperatures inside Boston Garden for years. James had previously experienced cramping issues in warm arenas, especially in later playoff rounds as summer arrived and heated the exterior air. He acknowledged that playoff games caused him more stress, and he was more prone to becoming dehydrated. Several times he needed IVs following playoff games, and he began a routine where he'd carry a jug of water around with him to constantly drink during the playoffs. He explained that playoff sweat is different than regular season sweat. During the 2012 finals, James cramped during Game 4 in Miami and was ultimately unable to finish. The Heat won that night, but in subsequent years, the engineering department at American Airlines Arena in Miami cranked the air conditioning on playoff game days to the point where it was almost uncomfortably cold. The AT&T Center had a bit of a reputation across the league for bizarre events. Bats were known to fly through the building on occasion, and once Spurs star Manu Ginobili captured one during a game, thereafter needing days of rabies injections. Just a few weeks before the air conditioning failed, the Portland Trailblazers found a snake in the visitors' locker room before a playoff game. The air conditioning failure instantly became a part of lore and fodder for conspiracy theorists, who noted all fans were given noisemakers that night that could be used as hand fans, while several industrial fans turned up in the Spurs locker room. It was all rendered moot after the Spurs won the final three games of the series with James healthy. After a 17-point loss in Game 5 that avenged the Spurs' loss to Miami the season before, it was clear who the better team was regardless of temperature. In the locker room, Shane Battier, who'd been a crucial addition to the team 3 years earlier, announced his retirement. Ray Allen then surprised when he hinted he was considering retirement after an 18-season Hall of Fame career. He never played another game. Rashard Lewis, a veteran of 15 seasons who started 4 of the 5 finals games, was soon forced into retirement because of knee issues. Greg Oden, who was on the team but didn't play much, was forced to retire from the NBA for the same reason. The team's doctors were quite busy during the season as Wade missed 28 games, mostly due to knee pain or to rest his knees. He had problems in both. His left knee had been an issue for years, dating to his Marquette days when he had his meniscus partially removed, procedure doctors nowadays avoid as much as possible because of its long-term effects. He needed several more surgeries, including one to his left knee before the 2012-13 season. Before Game 7 of the 2013 Finals, which the Heat won over the Spurs after a heroic effort from James, Wade needed to have the knee drained. He was also suffering in his right knee, where he dealt with pain for months because of bone bruises and irritation. So it was an old, battered, and tired Heat team, and the final loss felt more like a going-away party. James outclassed the rest of his teammates, scoring 31 points with 10 rebounds and 5 assists in Game 5. He did not share the feeling of relief. As the Spurs celebrated with champagne and planned an all-night party at a nearby Italian restaurant, James arrived at the post-game press conference. Within moments, he was asked about his future, as he had an opt-out clause in his contract with a decision due in 14 days. His answer ended up being telling. "I'm not disappointed in any of my teammates. Just wish we could have come through, played a better series," he said. He hadn't been asked about his teammates. Perhaps they'd given their best, but at that point, even after 2 championships and 4 consecutive finals trips, it was not enough. That answer made it clear that when thinking about his future, James was thinking about his teammates, the ones who would be left. 3 days later, Heat president Pat Riley called his own press conference back in Miami. These were traditional at the end of every season and often celebratory. Not this one. Riley sat down and immediately slammed his hands against the table. "You want to trend something? Trend this," he said, referring to social media. "I'm pissed. So go ahead, get it out there." He proceeded to go on a diatribe in which it slowly became clear he wasn't just speaking to the media and the fans, but also to his players. "Everybody needs to get a grip. Heat players, organization, all our fans, get a grip," he said. He talked about his time with the Los Angeles Lakers, during which the team won 5 titles over 12 years. "That means 7 times they didn't win. They didn't run. They didn't win, he said. This stuff is hard. You have to stay together if you've got the guts. You don't take the first door and run out of it. He compared the just-finished season to a Broadway show, saying it sort of ran out of steam. It was strange for Riley to be so cranky. He was a man who typically presented a front that things were under control, and everything happened for a reason, whether it was the truth or not. He'd been through so many events in his career, there were few things he didn't have a personal history dealing with, and a story to grease the message that he needed to deliver. He also usually had a plan, and often that plan was good. One of his greatest talents was his sales pitches, whether it was to players he was coaching, free agents he was trying to sign, or executives who paid tens of thousands to hear him speak. In 1987, at the rally celebrating the title, he famously guaranteed the Lakers would repeat as champions. It was brash and, with his custom shirt and designer sunglasses, unquestionably cool. But it was part of a plan. The previous two times he'd coached the Lakers to titles, they'd come back flat the following season and hadn't defended. Riley wanted to motivate them with his words. The Lakers got the repeat in 1988. Riley reacted by secretly filing a trademark for the phrase three-peat. Even when Riley didn't win, he was often spectacular in his efforts. Once, in 2000, he was hoping to sign major free agent Tracy McGrady. When McGrady came to Miami to visit, Riley arranged for him to board a boat at Heat star Alonzo Mourning's house and then speed across Biscayne Bay to Riley's waterside mansion to receive the contract offer. McGrady signed in Orlando, but that presentation beats the greatest PowerPoint in boardroom history. It was in the boardroom where Riley closed the deal on James in 2010, appealing to his desire to win championships by placing his 7 championship rings on the table to illustrate he knew how to get them for James. By the summer of 2014, Riley had 9 and James 2. So there was an assumption that Riley again knew what to do, that he'd looked ahead and had a plot ready to make sure James would be staying with his ring-producing machine. But the fiery press conference hinted he did not. All he had was a challenge to James's manhood. Riley's aggressive nature exposed several previously unknown things. One was that he and the organization were nervous about James's free agency and keeping the team together. The second was that Riley felt the need to give this message via the media instead of in person. He admitted his postseason meeting with James was brief, and they didn't discuss these themes in depth, as James was looking to leave on a head-clearing trip to the Bahamas. While Riley's message, that even great teams don't win every year, and failure often is a part of establishing a dynasty, was sage and even reasonable, his tone and methods seemed misplaced, especially for a player he was supposed to have a relationship with. A little more telling was that he announced in the press conference that James and his wife were expecting a third child, their first girl, that fall. James had taken steps to keep that information private in the previous months, something media members who knew him had been well aware of, and Riley mentioning it seemingly off the cuff was surprising. 5 days later, James opted out of his contract, a week earlier than he was required to. There was no other comment made, but other teams started to believe the rumors they'd heard, that James might be considering leaving after all. A day after he opted out, James, Wade, and Bosch got together for a late afternoon meeting at Soho Beach House, a private and secluded hotel in South Beach, where they discussed their situation. After ordering watermelon salad, chips, and guacamole, they talked about free agency. All three of them had opt-out clauses in their deals, but only James had exercised his at that point. They'd had a similar summit in 2010 before joining together to play for the Heat, when they'd agreed to align their decision-making. They'd also had more informal discussions in 2006, when they all believed they should sign 3-year contract extensions rather than the typical 5-year deals when they all played for different teams. It was expected this type of meeting would take place again. Only this time was different. There would be no decision or even a consensus. James had different representation, and he, Wade, and Bosch wouldn't be operating with all of them aware of the others' moves. Options were discussed, especially about the changing landscape in the league and how that might affect contracts, But James didn't know for sure what he was going to do, and he told them. In retrospect, Wade and Bosch would later say his indecision said everything. But at that place and time, it just came off as uncertainty. When it was over, Bosch went home, as he and his wife Adrienne were planning a long worldwide trip with his children. James and Wade went to Sun Life Stadium to attend a concert by friends Jay-Z and Beyonce, who were kicking off a tour. James's tone was relayed to the Heat offices. Their reaction played out quickly. Owners of the 26th pick in the NBA draft the following night, the team began calling around looking for ways to move up in the draft. Their target became known. They were chasing Shabazz Napier, the undersized point guard who'd led Connecticut to the national title that spring. Napier fit into the type of player Riley often likes. He was older after 4 years in college, had championship experience, and he was American. Riley typically didn't draft international prospects. Napier's resume resembled those of many other Riley picks, from Wade, who played 3 years at Marquette and went to a Final Four, to the team's current point guards, former NCAA tournament hero Mario Chalmers and four-year collegian Norris Cole. But there was another motive, and it was tied to James. During UConn's title run, James had marveled at Napier's playmaking. "No way you take a PG in the lottery before Napier," he wrote on his Twitter account during the title game, where Napier scored 22 points to lead his team to a win over Kentucky. The Heat obviously took notice. Even though they needed help at the wing positions after Battier's and Allen's statements, they traded 2 second-round picks to move from the number 26 pick to the number 24 pick to get Napier. It was pricey for such a modest move-up, but the Heat clearly had motivation, and it wasn't just to get Napier. "Why not?" Riley said that night. "If LeBron and I have the same taste and talent, so be it. But he didn't call me on the phone, or he didn't make a point to me about it." This was true. James had not discussed it with the Heat, and they had not talked on the phone since his opt-out. Riley would later criticize James for misleading the Heat when it came to Napier, who ended up being traded away after one unsuccessful season in Miami. The larger point was to get James's attention. On that front, it clearly worked. After the Heat made the trade, James went back to Twitter, writing, "My favorite player in the draft." It gave the impression that James and the Heat were on the same page. It also gave Riley some momentum and some hope for a mission he planned for the next night. That was at a wedding in the Coconut Grove section of Miami for Mike Mancias, one of the Heat's trainers, who was extremely close to James. James and Riley were both in attendance, along with numerous other Heat personnel. In a more relaxed and celebratory atmosphere, Riley hoped he would be able to go off into a corner with James and be able to have a conversation about the future. A veteran motivator and dealmaker who'd won James over in the past, he was hopeful he could do it again. It had certainly seemed to the Heat the move the day before to get Napier had energized James, and if nothing else, it would be an excellent conversation starter. But there would be no meeting. James kept his distance and wanted to do no business. Paul also attended the wedding, but did not meet with Riley. James and Paul had agreed they would have a systematic approach to this free agency. There would be a process, and Paul would be leading it. There would be no end runs or backroom sessions. It would be handled in an orderly fashion, and it would be handled after July 1st. There was a perception that Riley and James had to have some sort of falling out for it to reach this point. It wasn't that black and white. Despite Riley's efforts, the two never really had a falling in. They'd had talks, they'd shared meals and drinks, they'd embraced after titles. Riley always believed these moments created bonds for life. For James, it was always a business relationship. Riley could switch to business easily. He'd traded franchise cornerstones Tim Hardaway, Shaquille O'Neal, and Alonzo Mourning. He eventually let Wade walk over a monetary dispute. And in the end, he cut Bosch loose when the sides weren't on the same page on a medical issue. James had many warm moments with Riley, but he'd never lost sight of the reality. He knew Riley could be ruthless. He eventually began to resent he'd given the Heat a contract discount, only to see them cut some corners on salaries later. Ultimately, James's circle was small and tight, and Riley was never in it. That reality caught Riley and much of the Heat organization by surprise. James did have a few special audiences at the wedding that night. One was with Zydrunas Ilgauskas, who'd flown into town because Mancius had befriended him when working for the Cavs and Heat. That night, Ilgauskas told James he had decided to leave the Cavs organization, but they spent time talking about the status of the franchise. James kept asking questions about the roster and about the team's plans. But while Riley waited for his chance, James stepped into a private room for an important duty. Along with the bride and groom, Mike and Heather, he became the official witness in signing their marriage certificate. As it would turn out, it was the only contract he'd sign in Miami that summer. Chapter 4. I'm Coming Home. Midnight on July 1st is the most frenzied moment on the NBA calendar, the official opening of free agency. After midnight on July 1st, 2014, Rich Paul's phone went hot with calls and texts. Within a few hours, all 30 teams had made contact, letting him know they were interested in his client. In the league, where due diligence is demanded, it's not uncommon for a team to express interest in dozens of free agents after midnight, merely to test the waters. In many cases, talks start directly or indirectly days or even weeks earlier, despite rules against contact before July 1st. Over the previous 10 days, James had several serious conversations with Paul and Maverick Carter, his friend who heads many of James's off-court ventures, and Randy Mims, who travels with him throughout the year. These three and James's wife, Savannah, are essentially his inner circle, and they would be the ones involved in making this major choice. Also involved was Adam Mendelsohn, who had been James's media strategist since 2011. James knew for some time he was going to exercise his option to become a free agent. He had spoken with Paul, Carter, and family members about moving back to Ohio to play for the Cavs again at some point in the future. The reason the Cavs had even gotten their hopes up was because these feelings had trickled to them in various forms over the previous 18 months. But it was not a decision James had reached by the start of free agency. Just a few weeks earlier, the Heat had been tied with the San Antonio Spurs 1-1 in the finals after two games. Going home with the home court advantage, it seemed like a third consecutive title was within reach. Had that played out, James would likely have elected to stay in Miami to defend another title. Instead, the Heat lost three straight games and looked old and emotionally spent in doing so. The outcome of the finals had helped push going home to the front of James's mind, and that meant the hometown Cavs, even if they didn't know it, and all of their actions showed they didn't, were in the lead. They were there because James felt a pull to come play at home, where he could live in his Akron mansion and send his kids to Akron area schools, near all of his friends and family, and his wife's friends and family. And he could try to change the course of his career by trying to lead the woebegone Cavs to a championship. He'd followed the team and its moves, and he thought it would be possible. But everyone involved in the choice maintains when midnight struck on July 1st, the race was still very much in progress. With a decision of this magnitude, more consideration was needed. In the wake of how the process played out, not everyone believed this, certainly not the Heat, who in retrospect felt like what happened over the next week and a half was a damaging wild goose chase. But James maintained he wasn't fully sure if another option might be better. He also wasn't sure if he could work for Cavs owner Dan Gilbert again. By 2 p.m. on July 1st, Paul had returned every call. There were 24 thanks, but LeBron is not interested messages. Six teams were told James would consider them. The Dallas Mavericks, the Los Angeles Lakers, the Phoenix Suns, the Chicago Bulls, the Miami Heat, and the Cleveland Cavaliers. By July 2nd, Paul had explained James's general timetable and invited most of the teams to Cleveland for presentations beginning the next day, Thursday, July 3rd. Not only did these calls slow these teams' free agent moves, they effectively halted the market. It jammed players like Gordon Hayward, who went from a recruiting visit to an afterthought after a phone call expressing James's interest. At Paul's suggestion, James made it clear he was going to stay physically removed from the process. A few days before the start of the frenzy, he left on a family vacation to the Caribbean. Using social media, he let the world know he was away. As the finalists for James learned they'd made the cut, he posted a short video of his oldest son, LeBron Jr., reeling in a nice-sized blackfin tuna off the back of a boat James had rented for a family fishing trip. When he was a first-time free agent in 2010, James hosted six teams at his business office in Cleveland over a three-day period in early July. The meetings quickly became public and led to a media horde surrounding the building. Cameras were ready at the airport, catching owners and executives filing off planes. Reporters knew the order of the team's pitches, and video of their arrivals and departures was on SportsCenter every night. This time there would also be meetings in the Cleveland office, that of Clutch Sports, but it would be different. Minimal leaks, no waiting cameras, and no James. Paul and Mark Termini would hear the pitches and secrecy was requested. Representatives from teams began quietly arriving on July 3rd. Some surprised each other in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton, where most visiting NBA personnel stayed in Cleveland. Gilbert, ironically, owned the hotel. The Lakers were represented by general manager Mitch Kupchak. Suns owner Robert Sarver came with his front office. So did Mavs owner Mark Cuban, who inadvertently was spotted sitting in Public Square, which is adjacent to Clutch Sports' offices, drinking iced tea. The photo quickly made its way across social media. Cuban, who the night before had hosted free agent Carmelo Anthony in a pitch meeting at his home in Dallas, tried to cover it up and announced he was in town on business as a part of his television show, Shark Tank. The Bulls were led by Michael Reinsdorf, the son of owner Jerry Reinsdorf, and front office leaders Gar Forman and John Paxson, who had come 4 years earlier to pitch James as well. All of them had presentations explaining their plans for their roster and their teams going forward. Paul and Termini revealed nothing, taking notes and keeping their thoughts to themselves. The billionaires and executives tried to probe for info or read them. They got very little. Beyond the team's shows, Paul and Termini had two topics to discuss. Each team got the same two. First, all were told James would only be accepting a full max contract. Unlike in Miami, where he'd taken less than the premium number, there would be no discounting, no matter how much it might help the team in building its roster. And this contract might range from 1 year in length to the maximum of four. While a four-time MVP still in his prime getting the highest salary possible may seem like a foregone conclusion, that was not necessarily the case. Anthony, who was one of James's closest friends, said even before he became a free agent that he might be willing to take less than a max contract to help build the team, essentially the James, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh Heat plan from 4 years earlier. The New York Knicks, Anthony's team, seized on this statement. "He's the one that opened that up, that it wasn't about the money," said Knicks president Phil Jackson, who didn't take any discounts when he signed on to run the team for $12 million per year several months earlier. "So I challenged him on that because I want our fans to see he's a team player." The implication being that a team player would take less money. Beyond maximizing James's earnings during his prime years, it also appealed to him to set a tone. If he accepted less than a max contract again, it would set a precedent that was hurtful to his fellow stars. His doing so 4 years earlier had already affected the way fans and teams approached negotiations, as Anthony's situation showed. Cuban, who had never been afraid to pay and pamper talent, hinted in interviews before free agency that he didn't anticipate giving out any max contract offers that summer, even though he was soon to pitch Anthony and James. The Bulls, with high-priced stars Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah on their roster, didn't have enough cap space to offer any player a max deal without making trades. Yet they also pitched James and Anthony with less than a max slot, which was slated to be $20.7 million that year. The second topic from James's reps involved the NBA's luxury tax, which attached a monetary penalty for teams spending beyond established thresholds. Each team was asked whether they would be willing to pay the luxury tax and the repeater tax. In 2011, new rules were ushered in that made high payrolls more costly. The repeater tax was an even more punitive levy that was reserved for a team that paid the tax in 4 out of 5 years. As a result, teams had become more cautious in spending, especially the best teams with the highest payrolls. It certainly affected the Heat. Owner Mickey Arison was one of just 5 owners who voted against the new rules, and he publicly said he felt it was unfair to his team. While he still paid the luxury tax in 3 of the 4 years, a total of $34 million, that James played in Miami, he'd curtailed spending, and the Heat made a series of moves to shave payroll over James' last year there. James and his team believed competing at the highest level meant owners would have to eventually pay the luxury tax, and so he made it a prerequisite of his signing. On July 4th, Cavs general manager David Griffin drove over to meet with Paul in Termini. His presentation was more informal. He talked about locking up Kyrie Irving on a 5-year deal. He talked about how Andrew Wiggins, the prized #1 pick, could be an ideal partner for James. He talked about the extra draft picks the team had, a cupboard stocked by previous GM Chris Grant, that could be used as bait to trade for veterans. Yet as he delivered it, Griffin still wasn't sure the Cavs were truly in the running. Indeed, there had been some contact between Paul and the Cavs on this matter. Gilbert and Paul had direct discussions with each other, and at one point, Gilbert was a guest at Paul's Cleveland home. There were positive feelings and the impression of once-bolted doors being unlocked, but nothing close to a promise. The Cavs, having been burnt by James in the past, were cautious in making any sort of leap. Griffin, a brand new GM, had a brand new coach and a franchise player with a brand new contract, and none of them had to be tied to James at all. That's why Griffin had been proceeding with other free agents. In addition to staying in touch with Hayward, he'd made some progress with the agent who represented Chandler Parsons and felt the Cavs could structure a deal that would enable them to have a chance to sign him. Griffin was still hedging that James probably would go back to the Heat, likely on a 1-year contract, and he believed this meeting might lay the groundwork for 2015 when James could be on the market again. During the meeting, Griffin was given the same 2 bullet points as those before him. He was easily able to commit to owner Dan Gilbert's spending. Gilbert had spent $43 million in luxury taxes during James's first tenure. His willingness to lay out cash was legendary within the NBA, whether it was to players, coaches, both current and fired, or even tossing money into trades as a sweetener. The Cavs' facilities and services were among the best in the league. Their training facility on a wooded hillside overlooking the Cuyahoga River Valley is 5-star, even by NBA standards. From multiple chef-cooked meals per day to having someone start the players' cars in the middle of the night so they'd be warm when the team plane arrived home from road trips in the winter, Gilbert left no frontier unexplored when it came to pampering his team. But the second issue, the max contract, was a factor. At the time of the meeting, the Cavs didn't have enough salary cap space to pay James the max. In another example of how the team wasn't expecting to really get James back, they'd added some salary around the draft 2 weeks earlier and weren't in position to sign him to the big number at that moment. Griffin told Paul and Termini that if James were to commit to coming, he'd make trades to create enough room. This was not well received. Griffin was told if the Cavs wanted to stay in the game, they'd have to have the cap space. It was like poker, and this was the ante. After meeting with Griffin, Paul called co-owner Nate Forbes and asked him to help arrange a face-to-face meeting between Gilbert and James. James and Gilbert had heard each other, and they hadn't spoken for 4 years. James had flown back to Miami from the Caribbean the night before, and Gilbert was in Detroit for the July 4th weekend. When he left the meeting, Griffin still didn't fully know where his team stood. When he got back to the office, he huddled with his team, and they started brainstorming ideas on how to trade players to create cap space. They had laid the groundwork with some other teams to make cap space clearing trades, but they had been exploratory talks. Now it was time to get serious, and it was time for Gilbert to book a trip to Florida. On Sunday, July 6th, Gilbert boarded his Gulfstream IV jet at a suburban Detroit airport and took off for Fort Lauderdale. As he was in the air, a Cleveland radio host tweeted he was flying to South Florida. Within minutes, reporters and fans had found his plane and its destination on tracking websites, and speculation started flowing. Gilbert was going over what he planned to say to James as the plane traveled south when he heard the secret was out. His first move was to try to squash it, and he posted a lie on social media, saying he was actually in his backyard. Then he instructed his pilots to change the jet's destination from Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport to the more exclusive Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport, 13 miles to the north. I had a bunch of notes I was going over on the plane. I really needed to make sure I knew what we could do with the roster and everything and how much cap space we had, Gilbert said. Then it got out and I was talking to the pilots on how we could change airports. There was some drama. Gilbert took a car to a condominium where Paul had set the meeting. Paul and Termini had flown to Miami ahead of it. Gilbert came alone, as was requested, and wasn't sure who would be there to meet him other than James. Only James's inner circle was there. It was not a time of tearful apologies. It was a part of the process James and Paul had decided needed to be done. There were no promises made. There were no contracts offered. It was a look each other in the eye clearing of the air. The night James left the Cavs in 2010 was discussed. James's decision show where he announced his intention to sign in Miami had insulted and deeply offended Gilbert. Gilbert's angry letter had insulted and deeply offended James. Gilbert used a line he'd crafted, telling James they'd had 5 good years together and 1 bad night. Then he shifted to the future, talking about the talent on the team, the new coach he'd hired, the new deal Irving was about to sign, and his promise to surround him with talent. The two shook hands. Paul said he would be in touch. Gilbert went back to the airport and flew home. The next day, he had his plane blocked from public tracking services. I had no idea how long we'd have to talk about the past. The answer was not long. Maybe 10 or 15 minutes, Gilbert said. I'd gone over this in my head many times, and it was more comfortable than I thought it would be. We talked for 2 or 3 hours, and that was it. I felt good about it, and I thought we had a chance to get him to come back. But I didn't know what else he was doing or who else was bidding. When you're in something like this, you're always concerned about what you don't know. On Monday, July 7th, James filmed a commercial in Coral Gables, where he'd lived since moving to Miami. Later, he flew to Las Vegas, where he was planning to attend his annual Nike camp, the LeBron James Skills Academy, for top high school and college players. He was joined by Wade and some friends at Lavo, a pricey Italian restaurant inside the Palazzo Hotel on the Strip. The fascination with their meeting was intense, and the restaurant took advantage, putting out a press release saying they'd ordered steak and sea bass. In reality, it was not a strategy meeting, but actually a large group that later adjourned to a nearby nightclub, where one of James's other friends was DJing. There was no free agency discussion. Meanwhile, back in Miami, the Heat made their first two moves of the offseason. As they waited on the decisions from their big free agents, they agreed to a 4-year, $23 million deal with free agent forward Josh McRoberts, who had played against them in the playoffs as a member of the Charlotte Bobcats that spring. They also signed veteran Danny Granger, a former All-Star whose career had been derailed by knee injuries. These were seen as supplemental adjustments to replace some of the Heat role players who were retiring. Paul remained in contact with the Heat, but didn't invite them to Cleveland for meetings as he did the other teams. Because James had played there for the past 4 seasons, he didn't need to have as in-depth of a presentation. Instead, the Heat were invited to come to Vegas for an in-person meeting with James that week during James's camp. The meeting was set for that Wednesday, July 9th. The Heat were uncomfortable as the days passed and their stars remained on the market. But Riley was always confident he could close. The Houston Rockets had made getting Bosch, a Texas native, a priority, and offered him a 4-year, $88 million contract over the previous weekend. Bosch had been in Dubai riding camels, relaxing at a resort in the Maldives, and posing with elephants in Sri Lanka. And he'd flown to Ghana to take part in a camp for NBA Africa. He waited for James's decision before making his own. Like everyone else in the process, he had guesses but no hard information from James, and therefore had to leave his options open. The Heat felt some relief when James started spending time with Wade, who intended to re-sign in Miami. James and Wade worked out together the day after their dinner at James's camp, which was held at a convention center north of downtown Vegas. James routinely worked out along high school and college players at his camp, and often brought star friends to play in pickup games. Wade was still nursing sore knees, but was able to spend time with James. Like everyone else, however, Wade was left to guess and try to read the situation, as James was keeping his thoughts on free agency mostly to himself. Even though Wade had developed into an extended family member, he was not part of this decision. For his part, Wade decided he wouldn't actively attempt to recruit James to stay with him in Miami. By then, these two knew each other well enough that such a move would have felt shallow. James knew how Wade felt. Paul let some of the other interested teams know that James was moving on from them. Within 24 hours, the Mavericks finalized a deal with free agent Chandler Parsons. Meanwhile, Hayward agreed to a 4-year, $63 million deal with the Charlotte Hornets. Because he was a restricted free agent, the Utah Jazz matched the offer and retained him, which probably would have happened with the Cavs as well. The Bulls, who had also pitched Anthony, started focusing on signing free agent Pau Gasol. After the workout, James went to the Wynn, the hotel where he'd gotten comfortable as his base in Vegas over the years, because that was the home for USA Basketball when he played with the team over four summers between 2006 and 2012. There, he continued to seriously discuss the upcoming decision with Paul and Carter. A topic throughout the process was how this choice might end up defining his legacy. Could going back to Cleveland put him in position to change the way millions felt about his career? It was also a type of challenge he hadn't faced before. To be a part of the building of something and not just a hired gun, like he sometimes felt he was with the Heat. As they examined the options, which had essentially become Miami or Cleveland, the phrase that started to be used by the group was that going back to Cleveland would be a legacy play. James had paid close attention to the Cavs' moves. He knew a lot about their roster. One of the little hints he dropped was the previous fall, when the Heat made a visit to Cleveland for a game. Miami won as the Cavs were off to a bad start in what would become a lost season. But James went out of his way to compliment the team. He praised Irving as an incredible talent and talked about how the Cavs have some really good pieces. He knew that if he chose the Cavs, he would have input on the roster, and his team started talking about those choices. James didn't have much of a relationship with Irving. They'd been together at Team USA training camp in 2012, and both were represented by Nike. But Irving was more drawn to Kobe Bryant, whom he'd idolized. Nonetheless, James believed he could succeed with Irving because of his immense talent, and he believed he could mentor him. James never sought much counsel from older players when he came to the NBA, but had come to enjoy mentoring younger players, whether they wanted it or not. Most did, as James had been in the league 11 years and many young players had grown up as fans of him. But James felt he'd need a big man who could shoot to help him on the Cavs. The trio of him, Wade, and Bosch, a power forward who could defend centers and open floor space by shooting from the outside, had been a championship fit in Miami. James and his friends discussed who could be that player in Cleveland with him. They came up with three names, LaMarcus Aldridge, Kevin Love, and Carmelo Anthony, who could play as a forward alongside James. Aldridge was under contract in Portland, and it wasn't clear the Cavs could trade for him. Anthony was in the process of a national free agent tour, visiting Chicago, Houston, Dallas, and Los Angeles. But James didn't think he'd leave New York, much less come to Cleveland. That brought them to Love, who was coming off his best season and was available on the trade market. And James knew the Cavs could get him. The concept had been brought up by Griffin and Gilbert, but they needed Love's support, something James thought he might be able to deliver. The Cavs remained hopeful, but were getting nervous. Channing Frye, another of their free agent hopes, agreed to a contract with the Magic. They were thrilled to be in it with James, but nervous they'd be left with no one to sign if he re-upped with the Heat. Meanwhile, James Camp's communications were giving them nothing solid. Instead, they kept asking why the Cavs hadn't cleared cap space for a max contract yet. As the process was unfolding, Mendelson reached out to Lee Jenkins, a feature writer for Sports Illustrated who had done several cover profiles on James over the previous few years. In the spring, Jenkins and Mendelson had discussed how James might announce his free agency choice. Several months earlier, Jason Collins had used a first-person essay in the magazine to become the first active NBA player to announce he was openly gay. In addition, rookie-to-be Jabari Parker wrote an essay in SI announcing he was leaving Duke and turning pro. Regardless of what James would do, handling the announcement was of paramount importance. James had been badly burned by the decision broadcast in 2010, even though he and his team still believed it was a forward-thinking idea that put the power in the players' hands. It had raised seven figures for charity and changed the nature of the way athletes looked at making big announcements. The execution, however, was obviously flawed. In what had become a 140-character and soundbite world, James's utterance of, "I'm taking my talents to South Beach," defined the entire ordeal and destroyed the chance to give the choice context. The handling of the drawn-out broadcast was also a mistake. Mendelson, who built his career working in the political arena, had worked with James to consider a way to improve on the presentation with the lessons of 2010. Jenkins was asked to come to Vegas from his home in Los Angeles, though he wasn't told why or even promised an interview with James. If James decided to re-sign with the Heat, it might not have been seen as a choice that needed explanation. If he chose the Cavs, James knew he needed a way to explain his feelings with some depth and space. Jenkins booked a flight and took the 45-minute trip unsure of what he was going for. On Wednesday, July 9th, the Cavs finalized a three-team trade with the Boston Celtics and Brooklyn Nets. They traded Jarrett Jack and the remaining 3 years on his contract to Brooklyn. Jack had been a failed signing the year before, and getting his money, $6.3 million, off the team's books had suddenly become a priority. To do the deal, the Cavs had to pay with their 2016 first-round pick, which went to Boston. Also, the team traded Tyler Zeller and Sergei Karasev, two of their young prospects, to shed salary. When the dust settled, the Cavs had dumped $9.5 million and reached enough cap space to sign a max player. Their ante was finally and officially in the middle of the table. Shortly after the deal, Paul finalized a meeting with Gilbert and Forbes in Vegas the following day. Gilbert was in Sun Valley, Idaho, at the annual Allen & Company media conference. This was a transitional place for Gilbert and James. The event for billionaires, CEOs, and politicians is one of the most exclusive gatherings every year. In 2009, Gilbert had arranged for James to be invited. Allen & Company had helped arrange the purchase of the Cavs for Gilbert in 2004 and hoped to use the time to talk to James about a contract extension. The meeting didn't happen. The following year, Gilbert was in Sun Valley when James announced he was going to Miami, and he'd written his hot-blooded letter from there. Now, here he was in Idaho again on the verge of getting him back. That afternoon, Riley and Heat general manager Andy Ellisberg arrived for their meeting with James. This was Riley's chance to make his personal case to James. His message included selling the stability of the Heat organization, which is almost unmatched in pro sports, as Riley was in his 20th year with the team, Ellisberg was in his 26th, and coach Eric Spoelstra was in his 19th. The Cavs, meanwhile, had their third coach in 3 years and third GM in 6 years. Riley also talked about how he saw McRoberts and Granger, the new signees, fitting into the team alongside James's favorite player in the draft, Shabazz Napier. As the meeting was going on, two large semis pulled up to James's mansion back in Coral Gables. They were from an Orlando-based exotic car transport company, and they were there to load up some of James's cars to be shipped north, including the red Ferrari he loved to drive around the city. James shipped some of his cars to Akron every summer, But with tension building as his free agent choice lingered, it jolted Heat fans. When the meeting wrapped, James and Paul gave no hint to the Heat of their intentions. This unsettled Riley, who had hoped to close the deal. In the wake of it, both sides would have separate viewpoints. Riley felt like he'd wasted his time flying to Vegas when James had been in Miami for several days the previous week. There were also indications the Heat felt James had already made up his mind and was attempting to make Riley grovel. ESPN media personality Dan Le Batard, who was close with Riley, later said on his Miami radio show that Riley was offended that a World Cup soccer game was on television in James's hotel suite during the meeting, and Riley felt he didn't even have everyone's full attention. In a press conference a year later, Riley made a vague but pointed reference to his opinion of James and his team's behavior during this period, saying it had been smiling faces with hidden agendas. Bottom line, Riley felt disrespected. From James' perspective, Riley had been afforded a chance that no other team had. James didn't meet face-to-face with any other front offices. The Gilbert meeting didn't include Griffin, and James wanted to give Riley a chance to go last. In the immediate aftermath and years into the future, James and Paul insisted no final decision had been made when the Heat arrived for the meeting. James was indeed seriously considering a Cleveland return, but he was giving the Heat a final chance to make a compelling case, which supposedly Riley had always wanted. Bottom line, James felt this was paying Riley respect. Here was a reality that wasn't arguable. The years of competing for titles had exhausted the Heat of many of their assets to build a team. They were older, thinner, and had few options to add players, especially when compared to the Cavs. Miami was at this disadvantage because it had pressed so hard over the previous 4 years to surround James with a championship team. But the Heat were not going to be given favored status for these past actions. At that stage of his career, James had become all business when it came to his decision, the same way an organization might look at a once-valued player who was cut or traded when he'd passed his prime. From James's perspective, he was holding the Heat to the same standard. In short, there was no home team discount being offered. Riley and Ellisberg believed they could manage these challenges and keep the team in position to reach a fifth consecutive finals. That was a feat that hadn't been accomplished since the 1960s by the Boston Celtics. And with good reason. It's very hard to keep refreshing a team without taking a step back. But Riley and Ellisberg's track record was strong, and they had reason to believe in their plan. At that point, because of the circumstances, James needed to be blown away. Unlike in 2010, the Heat simply weren't able to do so. It wasn't the Heat's fault. They were competing for titles over the previous 4 years, while the Cavs, who had the worst cumulative record in the NBA over that span, were restocking. But that was the situation. On July 10, 2014, James called a morning meeting in his hotel suite with his inner circle. After the Heat meeting the previous day, he told his friends that he was close to making up his mind, but wanted to sleep on it. The group spoke for 45 minutes, going over the situation one final time. At the end, James came to his choice. He would return to Cleveland. The meeting broke up. James called his wife to tell her. Mendelson called Jenkins, who was in his room below. Jenkins took the elevator up to James's suite on the 58th floor. For the next 24 hours, he was going to be brought into the circle of trust. As James ate breakfast, Jenkins interviewed him. James would assemble a first-person essay that would be published in Sports Illustrated, and Jenkins would help him write it. The goal was for James to be able to explain himself in full and not be subjected to chopped-up highlights from a press conference. In fact, he had decided there would be no press conference. Jenkins is a gifted and award-winning writer. But the thoughts were James's. He talked about how his 4 years were like a college experience, one he'd never had. He discussed what it was like to grow up in Northeast Ohio. He discussed his emotions the night he announced he was leaving Cleveland. Jenkins recorded the conversation, and it didn't last long. He immediately went to his room to transcribe James's words and start putting together the essay. As Jenkins was holed up, James went to check on his Nike camp. When he arrived, Wade was with him. Their presence there together, a day after Riley had personally given his pitch,